The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So it's a smaller group than usual on Monday night. Does it mean everyone else is out trick-or-treating? You know, my first Buddhist tradition was Zen. And in Japanese Buddhism, which is from which Zen is part of, there is a kind of a Halloween-type festival called Segaki. I'm not sure. I think Gaki means hungry ghosts. And I think the se part of Segaki means to feed. So the hungry ghosts are this Buddhist idea in Buddhist cosmology, mythology, that there are these, they say the classic understanding in Buddhism is that there are these different realms you can get reborn in if you get reborn over and over again. And one of the realms is called the realms of the hungry ghosts. And it just happens to be for us that we're conventionally, nominally, born in the world of human beings. But if you're not careful, you will get reborn as a hungry ghost. And being born as a hungry ghost is not as bad as being born in hell. There's also kind of Buddhist hells. But it's not so good to be born as a hungry ghost. One of the reasons is that hungry ghosts have extremely big bellies, like huge. And they are always empty, and they're always hungry. Always want, food, always looking and searching around for food to fill that belly, and just kind of going around bugging people and trying to get the food. But another characteristic of hungry ghosts is they have extremely thin throats. Long and very, very thin throats. So thin, like thinner than a straw. So it's impossible for them to eat and food fast enough to fill those hungry stomachs. So they're always craving food. They're always feeling empty and always needing and wanting more, and grabbing for more, more. Mommy, more. Some of you know kids can be like hungry ghosts. You never give them enough candy on Halloween. They're getting sick. It's time to go to bed. No, but they're turning green. And this is, they have all their living room floor. They have all this candy. And the local school here, I thought they were really wise a couple of years ago, but I thought it was going to be a regular occurrence. But the local school here, my son's school, figured out not to have school on November 1st. Because there's no education happening November 1st. They're just babysitting. Because, the kids stay up late, they've overeaten sugar and, So hungry ghosts. And so in Japanese Buddhist tradition, then it's around midsummer. Some of you know the Obon festival. It's kind of part of that. They will do the ceremony to feed the hungry ghosts because they're so hungry. And so temples in Japan, Buddhist temples, all kind of turn themselves inside out to do this big ceremonies that involve putting out food and praying and doing things to these hungry ghosts, supporting them, feeding them, welcoming them. At the San Francisco Zen Center, which comes out of the Japanese tradition, they decided to continue with this Segaki custom, but instead of doing it in the midsummer, they do it on Halloween. And it's also used not only to feed the hungry ghosts, but it's also used, especially at Zen Center, to feed or to support or to remember or to help let go of, they say, people who have loved ones who have died in recent times. So that there's one time of the year at the Zen Center, where, which is Halloween, where it has this dual role to both to appease or to satisfy or to make them feel safe, these hungry ghosts that come out, but also to help support and to remember those who have died recently. And sometimes in Buddhism, there's an idea that it's possible that your loved ones have been reborn as hungry ghosts. So one of the reasons why you want to do this hungry ghost ceremony is to support and help them and feed them and stuff. But one of the reasons I want to tell you this is that, not just because it's kind of interesting, but there's one part of the ceremony at San Francisco Zen Center, I don't know if it's common in Japan, that it's very touching to me. And they say, it goes something like this, Welcome all that is partially known, unconscious, and unknown. Welcome and be safe. I think that's beautiful. So once a year, at least, we welcome all the demons and goblins and hungry ghosts. And we don't just welcome them, but we welcome them and say, come here and be safe. And then in Zen Center, there's all this feeding that goes on, I mean, ritual feeding at the altar. And I think in recent years at Zen Center, they do this ceremony all dressed up in costumes. But this idea of once a year welcoming the unknown, the partially known, the unconscious, because for me, I don't relate much to this idea of literally of hungry ghosts. Though I should be careful, right? Anyway. Niels Bohr was this famous physicist, and he had supposedly had a horseshoe above his door. And someone said to him, surely, Professor Bohr, you're not superstitious. You don't believe in that stuff, do you? And he said, no, I don't believe in it, but I've been told it works even if you don't believe in it. So I should be careful of these hungry ghosts. But I take it as being symbolic of our own hungry ghosts, our own demons and goblins. And there's plenty of them that many people have that get in the way, that often are repressed or ignored or denied, or not really treated well. And at least in the message here in this one day a week, one day a year, is to welcome the disowned parts of ourselves, to welcome the parts that we have pushed away and don't want to notice and don't want to, would rather not have, and welcome it and tell it it's safe. It's safe to be here for now. And I think that that's also the spirit of Buddhist meditation anyway. Buddhist meditation, I hope, is at least the kind of meditation we do, is one of the places in our lives. They're coming after me. they heard what I said. So where meditation is one place where we're not supposed to censor ourselves, and we're not supposed to push away or deny any part of ourselves, but to make ourselves safe for all of who we are to come forth, and to not be divided against ourselves. And one of the huge suffering that some people have is when they're divided against themselves. And I've seen people go through amazing struggles, spiritual struggles, personal struggles, where they have one part themselves which they say, I can't allow that to come forward. They try to be the opposite. But that part that they are denying will come out somehow anyway. And then these two sides are at war with each other. So sometimes if people have strong desires that are considered unacceptable socially, perhaps, and then they go, I can't do that, you know. Or they have certain fears or angers or resentments that society or their family says, you can't express those. If you express your anger, you're really bad. I'm going to treat you really, I'm going to push you away, or I'm going to attack you. Or terrible things happen to people sometimes when growing up, where, you know, if they express their anger or something. And so that part of themselves gets pushed down or gets struggled, or they internalize the oppression, internalize the idea that this part of themselves is bad. But it doesn't go away. And so the anger is there and it comes up, and the anger part hates the good part, and the good part is at war with the anger part. And there's no winning when we're divided against each other. There can't be any winning. Because if one side wins, then part of who we are loses. And, you know, if part of us loses, there's no winning, right? And so meditation is a time to allow all of who we are to come forth so it can be seen, so it can be held in a way that it feels safe and where there's not war anymore going on. So so it's for many people, I think, this idea that sitting in mindfulness meditation is a place where you're supposed to allow whatever is bubbling up inside of you to appear freely so you can see it and become free of it rather than dismiss it or push it away, is some people, it's a very foreign idea. And for some people, it's a very refreshing idea or a very liberating idea, because it's been so exhausting to keep things at bay, to push things away or to deny it or have this kind of war going on. Not that all of you, and there's a lot of war going on amongst all of you here, but I think it's worth one day a year to reflect on what is it, what part of you would you rather not admit to? Is there a part of you that you kind of try to ignore or try to hide from other people, hide to, from yourself? Is part of yourself that you're afraid of, that you're worried about? Or is a part of you that's a hungry ghost, where you can't get enough, you're needy and wanting more and more? In Buddhist circles, sometimes they say that the hungry ghost syndrome arises when people feel that their safety, their well-being, their happiness is found outside of themselves, and they're searching and wanting to hold on to something external that's going to do it for them. And sometimes people will find something external that works for a while, but it's, you know, it's always going to be fragile. And I think part of us kind of knows the fragility of it, and so it doesn't, not really satisfying. And so often there's a, you know, holding on tight or trying to get more, or finding more and getting more. And so the hungry ghost is this unsatisfied, empty place inside that's always looking and searching. And when it's quite strong, that searching and wanting and desiring, it tends to put blinders on us. And those blinders, again, creates a split. The part of us, one part of us that we're focused on getting and wanting that seems so important, and another part that's left out. And sometimes what's left out is not the hungry ghosts or the demons or the goblins, but rather is the saints. If we use that dichotomy, that duality, which is what we're doing, right, today and tomorrow. Tomorrow is All Saints Day, and today is the Halloween, the evening before the Hallow Day, the sacred day. And so so goblins, and someone has let the goblins and ghosts out on Halloween, and they'd run around like crazy, their last chance before the All Saints Day, when everybody is at their best behavior, I guess. Maybe some of you understand the myth better than I do. So sometimes what's discounted or ignored within people is their what's beautiful and noble within them. And there's something, so meditation, as I like to think of it, is a place to welcome all of who you are and make it feel safe. One of the questions I like to ask people, especially on retreat, not uncommon for people on retreat to feel a lot of fear. Not everyone, but people will go through it sometimes. And it's a little bit of a paradox because retreats are some of the safest places on the planet, retreats we put on. And people get afraid. And the reason they're often afraid is that all the external distractions and concerns fall away, and they discover deep inside there's maybe some deep-seated, deep-rooted, deeply embedded fear that's been carrying around for a long time, and it starts to stand out by itself more strongly than ever before because it's not being distracted from it. And so in this very safe place, people feel quite afraid. And one of the questions I'll ask people is if they have any ideas about what they could do to make themselves feel safer while they're on the retreat. What would make it feel safe enough to let this fear come forward? Because it has to come forth, and it's a little bit counterintuitive because many people feel like you can't let the pain, the difficulty come forward. But how can you make it feel safe to come forward? And so people usually come up with some kind of idea and will try to implement it. It's usually pretty simple. So that they could feel safer just letting it come and be seen. Sometimes people are really filled with anger. And not that it's common, but it can happen sometimes that rage can bubble up. And something that's completely socially unacceptable. And if it's really strong, then sometimes I'll say, go into the woods. And there, when you're in the privacy of being out in the woods, let it come forward, your rage and your anger. And the idea being, let it come forth and let it be seen. Let it come forth and let it feel safe. Don't act on it. Don't act on the anger. Don't go out and beat someone up. But let it come forth so it can be seen. Let it come forth so that it can be held and feel safe. Because if what we're afraid of inside of ourselves, that which we've separated from and pushed away from ourselves, can come forth and feel safe and be seen, it can relax. And to have it relax is one of the most useful things it can do. Have the anger relax, have the fear relax. Let it relax. Don't be so afraid of these difficult things. And then let it, and then you might discover something really beautiful that's there. So one of the Buddhist tales that, there's a few Buddhist tales I want to tell you. Fables or stories. One is the story of the Yaksha. Yaksha is an Indian, I like to call it a troll. It's kind of a tree spirit, but for our purpose I say it's a troll, so you don't know what a Yaksha is. And this one, it was an ugly little runt of a troll. And he went up to visit the heavens of Brahma, one of the great lords of heaven. And Brahma has a great palace with a great throne. But that day, Brahma was off somewhere, doing what Brahma does elsewhere. And so this ugly little runt of a troll went and jumped up on Brahma's throne. Now, no one should ever get on Brahma's throne except Brahma, because, I mean, he's like the top of the hierarchy, and you don't sit on the throne of Brahma. So the other gods, the minor gods in the court there in the palace, got angry and said, "You can't sit up there. You have to get off. You know, that's terrible." And as they were telling him to get off and being angry with him, the yaksha started to grow. This troll started to grow. Not only started to grow, but grew and became stronger, stronger, and more beautiful, until he became huge and radiant and beautiful. So the gods got kind of confused. So they went and found Brahma and said, "Brahma, there's this problem back at the palace. there's this ugly little runt of a troll that sat on your throne and got bigger and bigger and bigger and beautiful and strong, and we don't know what to do. And so Brahma said, oh, I know. So Brahma returned to his palace, and he stood in front of his throne, and he said to this troll, said he bowed, and he said, it's nice to see you. Thank you for coming. I hope you're comfortable up there. And as he started speaking kindly to him and nicely to him, the troll started to shrink and shrink and smaller and smaller and smaller until finally the troll, poof, vanished. So then Brahma got up on his throne and then he explained to the other gods what was going on. He said, this troll was an anger-eating troll. And the more you were angry, the more he got fed, and the bigger he would get. But if you stop being angry, it had no more sustenance, and he would just vanish, disappear, shrink away. So I like this story because do you have something comparable? Are there ways in which you're feeding your demons with your anger? Are you making certain things worse? I know that I have resisted parts of myself, and for me, sometimes I've resisted my anger. I used to, when I was younger, I hope it was only when I was younger, I had kind of blinders on where I had a self-identity where I wasn't supposed to be an angry person. And so with that kind of self-identity, you know, then I didn't notice when I was angry. And sometimes people would say, Gil, are you angry? No. And so that very anger sometimes fed my frustration. And I could feel, you know, there was kind of self-feeding mechanism where the more angry I got and didn't recognize it, the more it feed my frustration, how things were going, and the more angry I would get. And it was kind of ugly sometimes. So by turning towards the demons and the goblins and the trolls and making them feel safe and kind and feel our kindness, something it begins to relax and it's not being fed and sometimes things will fade and fall away. One of the things that can sometimes fall away is the way we're divided against ourselves. And so that sense of division or the fighting begins to relax. And it's these different aspects of ourselves don't have to be at war with themselves. And so we can feel and be together and perhaps reconcile themselves. The other story I want to tell you was the story of Milarepa, and a famous story that I don't remember exactly how it goes, but that doesn't matter because it's Halloween. Or maybe every time these stories are told, they're told anew anyway. But Milarepa was this Tibetan saint, this Tibetan practitioner of old, kind of an ascetic practitioner, and he was living, practicing in a cave. And he didn't know that somehow the cave was inhabited by fierce, human-eating demons. And so one night, a bunch of these demons came out of their depths of the cave, and it started approaching him, gnarling and snarling and licking their lips ready. And so he saw them coming, and so the first thing he thought of doing was to praise them, kind of, you know, flatter them and praise them. And he did that, and some of them then returned and left him alone. And then, but some of them kept advancing on him. And so then at some point, he said, well, I'll try something else. So then he took a fierce, wrathful stance and snarled back and was angry and like, you know. And that frightened some of them, apparently. So some of them left, but the biggest and meanest one of them kept advancing. And so again, when he got close enough with his big, open mouth, big teeth, Milarepa jumped in and lay down in his mouth. And with that, the demon vanished. So that's a brave thing to do. So are the things that you're afraid of looking at, afraid of dealing with, afraid of turning towards, conflicts in your life, truth-telling, are the things that you'd rather not talk about with people, rather not face in yourself? And what would it be like to turn towards it and throw yourself into its mouth and say, here I am. Let's just really not run away anymore or chase it away, but really feel and be present for this thing. And so here we are on Halloween, which some people use to get dressed up as their that which is often they're not usually don't, the persona they usually don't express in everyday life. But all of you came here instead of dressing up, unless you are dressed up. And this is what it looks like. And so I wonder from you, what are some of the things that you're familiar with? Maybe no one wants to tell about themselves, but you've seen it in other people. What do you know? What do you know? What people deny and push away of themselves? What are the shadows and the uncomfortable parts that people don't want to look at? I'll start by saying something about what I've seen in Buddhist circles. I don't know. I don't think it's universal in all Buddhist circles, but in some Buddhist circles, including things like here at IMC, probably. That certain values get emphasized, like maybe being kind and gentle and peaceful and calm, equanimous, enough to make you sick sometimes. and in that kind of environment, then, you know, it's not really so, it doesn't feel so comfortable to come in and be angry, you know, bitter, resentful, and grouchy. And so sometimes people won't show that side of themselves. And so it gets pushed to the side. And so it's said when things get pushed to the side in a community or in an individual like that, or not looked at or not given expression or somehow denied, it creates a shadow. So the Jungian idea of the shadow, that somehow it's there, it still operates a little bit in the shadow, it still operates unseen, and festers or is a sore or comes around in unhealthy ways. So that's one thing that sometimes we see is when a family or a community or a culture overemphasize one value, then the opposite value sometimes gets short shrift, and that can cause problems. So what are some of the things that you've seen that people have trouble accepting, seeing in themselves, that they push away? Yes?
I haven't known many men who are willing to cry.
Men who are willing to cry.
It's pretty sad.
It seems sad.
No, it seems sad, whatever the thing is.
Oh, when things are sad, yes. Some men are not willing to cry.
Not the ones I've known.
None. I've known people who have said that they're growing up when they were a small kid. Their father would sometimes hit them or yell at them or tell them, you know, real men don't cry, and so they would just kind of swallow it up. I also knew someone who was told he couldn't cry growing up, and so he would always go into the bathroom or go someplace. They made it very kind of private.
Wanting affection and eye contact and warm fuzzies from other people, but not wanting to admit that, and then it becomes I need to be cool and on top of things, and I'm the one who will be kind to you, but I don't want to show that that I really want and need your kindness.
Yeah, so wanting affection or kindness, and but feeling it's not okay to ask for it or even to show that you have the need or the desire for it.
So, yeah, uh-huh. And that can, it seems like, can get kind of scary because we get kind of hard and looking as if we've got it all together when we really don't.
Okay, thank you. Good, please.
Admitting failure.
So admitting failure is not okay. Mm. So we might fail, but we don't tell people that we failed. It's like when I was growing up, this was kind of a joke in my family, but we used to go skiing. And so at the end of the day, if someone asked, you know, if you fell, you say, oh, almost. You weren't supposed to say that you actually did fall. But I mean, that's silly, right? But there are much more serious things, yes, admitting failure. There's a beautiful story, if I may, of, I think it's nice, of Ruth Denison. Ruth Denison is the most senior Vipassana teacher in America. She's ancient. People are not sure how old she is, but maybe she's 90 or something. Some years ago, she was tending to her husband, her ex-husband. He moved back, and she took care of him at a retreat center she had. And he had Alzheimer's, and she would stay up all night caring for him and tending him. And then she had a teaching to do up in Oregon. She's down in Southern California. And so she spent, you know, all this time taking care of him, and then she jumped in her car and drove all the way up to Oregon. And that Friday evening, she was supposed to give a public talk at a big gymnasium. And she was exhausted. And so she started giving the talk, and she told a story. And then she continued the talk, and then she told the same story again. And then she talked for a while, and then she told the same story again. And, you know, people started looking at each other, you know. You know, what's going on? This old lady, you know, she's losing it here. And when she started to tell the story again, a whole bunch of people started to get up to walk out. And as they were walking out, she said, stop. You are seeing something really special. You are seeing one of the most senior Buddhist teachers in America fail. Everybody sat down. So admitting your failure in front of publicly in front of all those people. So thank you. Yes?
I was just saying, believing that if you can't say something nice, you shouldn't say anything at all, such to the point that you can't stand up for yourself.
Mm. Yeah. So how do you stand up for yourself and how do you be honest and stand up for yourself even when it's uncomfortable for other people? Thank you.
I think sexuality as well, you know, like feeling sexual or lustful or like...
Not you, of course.
No.
No, not you. No,
we're talking about... using this opportunity.
Yeah, those people.
Put it on other people.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I think that can, like, I don't know, that can reverse into shame.
Yes.
So it can be pretty negative.
Yes, so. I agree. One of my failures as a teacher is the last time I gave a Dharma talk about practice and sexuality was something like 1995. And so that's a long time ago. And so people who listen to come here a lot might think that, you know, that there's no place for sexuality in Buddhism because, you know, I better not admit it or talk about it because, you know, Gil never talks about it, so it must be wrong or I don't know what they think. So, you know, it's about time I gave a talk on a topic, but
such strong insecurities about myself and my performance, my abilities, that I will keep people around me whom I believe make up for my shortcomings, but who also have qualities that cause a lot of suffering. And because I imagine myself to be dependent on them, I continue to keep them close and therefore cause suffering for myself as well as the people around me.
Mm. And you can't really address the difficulties they have as because you're afraid of disturbing the status quo?
I do address it. I'm addressing it this week, a big one. But the internal conflict and the level of internal suffering is huge.
Mm. I wish you well with it.
Thank you.
Since Elaine told something on herself, I'll do likewise about... I just got back from a meditation retreat, and I found myself being very irritable and impatient. The idea came up when you were, had mentioned about people being super nice. And sometimes, you know, you're in line or something, and someone, you know, they're there first, but you come up and they say, oh, why don't you go first? And the other guy says, oh, no, no, please, you go first. And then you go first. They stand there for, you know, it seems like forever, you know, doing this silly dance, and I just want to say something foul and say, just go. Which, so I, you know, end up not feeling very much in the spirit of metta. It was helpful when one of the teachers said, though, when you're doing a lot of metta, it can bring up the dark side too.
Yes.
So that was helpful to have that reaffirmed, and I didn't chew anybody out or anything.
Good.
Maybe some nasty looks, but
so my solution to that problem when I did a retreat at the same place many years ago is I always made sure I was last to the meals when the lines were all gone.
Sometimes I could take extra amounts and nobody would be watching. They always have this grubby little bit of granola there. They just want you to use it as a condiment, you know, a couple tablespoons. And if I'm at the end of the line, I just take the whole thing and dump it in my dish. That way nobody sees. Let's talk about the hungry ghost. Cover all of them here today while we're at it.
So please, more confessions. In the back there, straight back in the corner.
I don't know if this is going to go over so well in a crowd of such young people. There was some more abstract. It's not practical yet, but like not really wanting to be involved as my parents get old. Like there are people I visit, but not necessarily someone I want to take care of. And same with my in-laws. I mean, it's kind of how I feel, and I realize that the culture doesn't think that's so cool, but I don't know if that's...
Yeah.
So part of me doesn't want to do it, and part of me feels bad for not wanting to do it. And we'll see what happens if, depending on how they go.
Yeah, it can be hard sometimes with family where you feel some obligation to treat family in a certain way, but you don't actually want to. And so then it's kind of socially unacceptable because they're family, right? But you don't really want to. So how do you deal with this sense of obligation and sense that you can't really admit such a, you know, that you don't really care to do something or to happen sometimes? Or a little bit, maybe a variation of that is the idea. Some people, when someone dies, a family person dies, rather than feeling a lot of grief, some people feel relief. And then they feel guilty and they don't feel like they can share that. It feels like it's bad. They must be a bad person to feel, you know, that. There's a whole slew of ways. So that gives, you know, that thank you for those of you who spoke. And my hope is that those of you who spoke maybe encourages those of you who didn't to reflect a little bit on these things and think about yourself. And to be willing to... And it's not necessary to admit all of what's going on with you to others. But it is necessary, if you want to practice this practice, to admit it to yourself. And look at it in a clear and serious way. And there's something very profound that happens when we create the inner safety for all of who we are. And we allow our thoughts, our feelings, our beliefs, our memories, or whatever, to come up without criticizing them, without attacking them, without judging them, without holding on to them, without praising them, without celebrating them. We don't have to do anything but let it come forth and come up. And I've seen over and over again myself and many students that I've had that there's a self-healing process. There's a self, I guess self-healing is probably the best word, a movement towards wholeness or a movement towards peace or a movement towards resolution that can happen on its own if we hold it in not in safe awareness, an awareness that's safe and non-violent, non-critical, but bring it forth, let it come forward without acting on any of it, but let it just float in the field of our awareness, because nothing is static. And if we can let all the things that are difficult within us come forth, and all the things which are beautiful within us, then there's a self-healing or settling or resolving process that we could never orchestrate for ourselves. And so if we get out, it's almost like we learn how to get out of our own way. And if we keep the war going, or if we are pushing part of ourselves off, or denying and ignoring, then we are shortchanging ourselves a very profound and meaningful form of self-healing or self-resolving that our hearts are capable of. And one of the things that has been very important for me in my practice is the degree to which I've learned that I can trust the mindfulness practice, I can trust the heart, I can trust all this if I've learned how to hold everything freely and openly in my heart in awareness. So here we are on Halloween, so we're reminded that sometimes it's good to turn towards or intentionally call forth that which we, or reflect on, what is it that we're ignoring? What is it we've pushed away? What are our demons that we haven't really given enough time for? And perhaps you also can jump into its mouth. You want to say something? Yes?
I wanted to remind people of the multiple uses of different kinds of art therapy, which I could create for myself to help bring, put on paper or something, or in a sandbox or whatever, something I want to look at, but then I can destroy it later before anybody else sees it. And I can be still safe.
Beautiful.
And yet I will have looked at it.
That's beautiful, yes. Art therapy is a great thing to do, to bring forth. So so be safe. May all of you be safe. Thank you.